It squanders the benefits of critical thinking when we choose to remain uncritical of socialized biases that aren't affiliated with religious claims.
Welcome to the Humanist Hour, the official broadcast of the American Humanist Association. In this episode, find out what exactly a social justice coordinator does, what social justice and intersectionality mean, and the ways that social media can be used to further the cause of social justice. Over the past year or so, the American Humanist Association has been making changes to reflect its commitment to social justice. These changes can be found in the pages of The Humanist and the words of its leaders. Change can also be found more recently in the announcement that Sincere Carrabo would be stepping into the role of AHA's social justice coordinator. This week, we welcome Sincere back to the show. He speaks with Peggy Knutson and Jen Wilson about his new role, what social justice and intersectionality mean, and the ways that social media can be used to further the cause of social justice.
Our guest for today has an extensive background as an activist in the social justice movement, which we'll delve into here. And you might also be familiar with his writing from Pathos, Everyday Feminism, and The Humanist, among other sites. In early March, he came on board officially with the AHA as Social Justice Coordinator, and it's our pleasure to introduce Sincere Carrabo.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's a delight. I guess it's been a busy time for you.
Yes. Got a lot of stuff going on right now with the new position and all.
Well, to begin, for our listeners who aren't yet familiar with you, why don't you tell us just a little bit about your background and how you came to identify as a humanist?
So, like most others early in life, I inherited the religious beliefs of my parents. So, they were Pentecostal Christians, and so being primed and groomed in this type of environment, so was I. So, you know, I was raised in the church. But it wasn't until I was 18 that I began to take my faith seriously. I was a self-described Jesus freak. And I used to call myself that, like, proudly. I was extremely devout for a few years there. I began to get curious about some of my faith's claims after reading the Da Vinci Code. I can't remember what caused me to read. I don't remember. But that led to an examination of church history. Historian commentary on how church doctrine was conceived, how it was conceived, influenced, and changed by men and different church sects over the course of centuries, you know, and then this created doubts and even more uncertainty. And I began to study, as a result, I began to look more into mythology, philosophy, and other religious traditions and learn more about the influence of all these different factors that went into creating Christian ideology, like Orphism, Platonism, Aristotelian philosophy, and so on. So, I mean, my deconversion process was like a slow dissolve that took place over a couple years, and I eventually accepted that I was an atheist and that I no longer believe these things, these fantastical religious claims, and that there was simply too much contrary or insufficient evidence to believe in these unfalsifiable claims of the God hypothesis. As far as my background with the secular movement, I first got involved in the secular movement by becoming a board member of Black Nonbelievers in 2013. And then the year following, I became a regional director with American Atheists. And the former with Black Nonbelievers, that really inspired me to get more involved and network more with atheist-focused activities. And then the latter got me more involved with opposing religious influence and legislation. And so last year, I began to do volunteer work with the African Americans for Humanism organization, which is an extension of CFI, Center for Inquiry. So over time, basically, I came to the same realization that the author, humanist author Dale McGowan did when he said, atheism is the first step, humanism is 1,000 steps that follow. So that's how I got to that point.
That's a great way to put it. First step and the 1,000 steps to follow. What can you tell us about the humanism movement in the Black community?
It's not really, I mean, we're still trying to get more to openly identify because due to the social context of this society and how the Black church has had such a huge influence on the Black community, you do have Black non-believers and you do have Black humanists, but it's very, of course, it's going to be far more minute numbers than non-POC. And then on top of that, you do have those who don't believe and that are humanists, but they won't openly identify. And part of that is due to fear. Part of that is due to not wanting to alienate family members and so on and so forth because of the social environment, because repudiating the Black church in some, to some extent, is like repudiating a part of the Black identity.
Can you describe what the social justice movement means to you and what it means to be the coordinator, social justice coordinator at AHA?
As far as my role as social justice coordinator with the American Humanist Association, my role primarily focuses on aiding the AHA's affinity groups. This includes working with MAF, or Military Association of Atheists and Freethinkers. I'm working with transitioning the Feminist Caucus into the Feminist Humanist Alliance, as well as the LGBTQ Humanist Council into the LGBTQ Humanist Alliance. And I'm also helping construct the framework for what will eventually become AHA's newest initiative, Black Humanist Alliance. So just dealing with these groups that more specifically address the intersection of social groups that are marginalized. So the intersection of that and humanism, that's what I'm primarily focused on as social justice coordinator. But as far as like the emphasis on social justice, insofar as humanism is concerned, it's like during the time I was involved with the efforts of the atheist organizations that I mentioned before, I gradually got to the point where the narrow-mindedness of mainstream atheism just wasn't enough. And by mainstream, I'm talking about the widely accepted beliefs and values usually associated with the movement, insofar as being primarily preoccupied with separation of church and state, scientific literacy, religious hegemony, and religious privilege. So while I think addressing those issues are important, it's undeniable that there are social issues that impact the lives of marginalized minorities that haven't anything to do with the religious context or God beliefs. So, I mean, denigrating religious claims does nothing to undo racism and white supremacy. Proving creationism is absurd doesn't erase patriarchal influences that reinforce things like male privilege, toxic masculinity, sexism, misogyny, and so on. Or if I were to cite reason number 392, reason why I'm an atheist, doesn't erase trans antagonism or all the ways our heteronormative culture marginalizes the LGBTQIA community. So Me proclaiming and showing how this or that religious tradition is absolutely bunk doesn't do anything to remedy the way certain groups are disadvantaged. So This is where humanism comes in and social justice. So my thinking began to evolve some time ago, and concern for social justice was kindled in the process. So for whatever reason, within atheist circles, there's a tendency to closely associate critical thinking with science and analyzing religious claims. And there's a tendency for it to like end there. But critical thinking in and of itself is a form of formal reality testing, period. So to only extend its use to the domain of rejecting God beliefs and promoting science, and to not also apply it to the many manifestations of privilege and discrimination and oppression that has major effects on everyday lives, of the quality of life of marginalized identities and groups. It's I find that to be parochial. So I mean, it's short-sighted, and it squanders the benefits of critical thinking when we choose to remain uncritical of socialized biases that aren't affiliated with religious claims.
Right. And how do we adjust, or how do we address that issue that when we're talking about equal rights, it doesn't mean that a certain subset is losing their rights, but only diminishing long-held privilege. I see this argument that people feel if one group gains rights, that diminishes their rights. And I argue against that and seem to get nowhere.
All right. Well, I think I would have to, can I describe like what intersectionality means? Because I think that helps me.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Okay. All right. So I've heard this too. It's weird to me. But so I have to set up the why behind the term intersectionality originated as a legal concept and was coined by legal scholar and activist Kimberly Crenshaw as a way to describe the multiplicity of ways oppressions are experienced. She used it as a way to exhibit how Black women experience a unique discrimination that intersects with racism and sexism, and that this discrimination can't be categorized solely as racist or solely as sexist, but must be examined as a combination of the two. And she further observed that the way Black women are frequently absent from the analyses of gender oppression and racism, because the gender oppression, usually when we're talking about these things, it usually centers on the experiences of white women. And when we're talking about racism, we usually tend to focus on the plight of Black men. So when we saw this play out actually during the suffrage movement, when women started fighting more for the whites, it was at rights. It was usually centered on white women, and Black women tended to be erased from that conversation. And we also see it today, even when we speak of like Black Lives Matter and racial injustice, the first names that usually come to mind are unarmed Black men. Like, so we think of like Eric Garner and Tamir Rice or Michael Brown, but erased from major consideration within this narrative of racial injustice are the stories of Yvette Smith or Sharice Francis or Tariqa Wilson.
You're listening to The Humanist Hour. Today, Peggy Knutson and Jen Wilson are talking to Sincere Carrabo, the American Humanist Association's new social justice coordinator, about his role and what we can all do to promote social justice.
So likewise, and more broadly, an intersectional approach is necessary to better contemplate and appreciate the way we are made up of multiple identities. We're layered, and each is accorded a certain level of value or lack thereof. So as a straight man, I'm privileged in some ways, right? And I don't experience specific bigotries and oppressions related to gender identity or sexual orientation. However, at the same time, I'm Black and am subject to other specific injustice and discrimination due to the nature of our white-oriented anti-Black culture all at the same time. So really, when it comes to the question that you're asking, it comes down to what Audre Lorde said when she said there's no such thing as a single issue struggle because we don't live single issue lives. That's why it's imperative that we adopt principles of intersectionality so we can upgrade our perspective and our appreciation and enhance our compassion for others, as well as the capacity for understanding the world that is made up far more than our insular experiences. And now for people who are used to things usually being their way or going the way, that's where you see a lack of intersectional approach to reality. So for those who are privileged or who possess privileged social positions, a loss of what they're groomed to feel entitled to feels like oppression. I mean, which from the outside looking in seems absurd, right? Like when you look at Christians who sincerely believe that they're being persecuted for their beliefs, despite the fact that Christian hegemony has and continues to greatly impact every facet of this society since the birth of this nation, it's hard to not see these claims as anything but laughable. So likewise, when we observe white people who truly believe reverse racism is an actual thing, and that they think they're being discriminated against more than minorities. Again, we're minorities, those who are of the minority group. So for them to think that, it's hard to not view this disgruntlement as anything other than like as being thoughtless and just severely uninformed, given that power attitudes are informed by racial stratification that place whites at its pinnacle for centuries now. So the very same thing can be said of men and the way women have and continue to be othered. So when it comes to white men, that's a double whammy. So what's important is to better address issues like that. It takes immersion into the struggles of others. I think that would be an appropriate response to the problem. Now, immersion, when I say immersion, I've written about this before. It's actually on thehumanist.com. The three keys that I often recite is observing, constancy, granting a platform, and perspective taking. So observing constancy means we're continually engaging in this immersion process of trying to address these issues. Okay. But also in conjunction with that, we have to grant a platform. And that means those of privileged positions decenter themselves and their experiences and allow those of marginalized identities to share their lived experiences and perspectives with them. Now, also part and parcel to this process is perspective taking. See, it's all one process. That's why I call it immersion. Perspective taking is basically creating social bonds and creating increased contact with people from marginalized groups. So, I mean, neuroscience studies indicate perspective taking combats automatic expressions of implicit biases. And those are the type of prejudices that keep us from being able to see us losing privilege for the betterment of society is, you know, that prevents us from seeing that as being a good thing.
Well, I'm sort of seeing an epidemic of what seems to be middle-aged white male Christian. Their death rate is increasing because of suicide and alcoholism. There's been some studies that have been done recently on that. And it seems to me like perhaps it's a feeling of diminishment of privilege, which is being seen as loss of right. I don't know if that's the case. That's just one take on it, I suppose.
Yeah, I don't know about that. I don't know.
I'm also reminded of a recent post you made on Pathos, and there was just a terrific quote in there that, you know, really sums up what you've been discussing here. Because we don't live single issue lives, as you stated, we do well to avoid rallying behind exclusionary agendas. And that's so important right now, especially in the political climate we've got going in this election year, which is frankly alarming in so many ways. And part of what I appreciate so much about your activism and all of your writing is that you directly challenge people to get out of our comfort zones and to create contact with, you know, people, ways of life that, you know, we're not necessarily involved in or aware of yet. And that brings me to a question. How would you recommend that people get started on that path? I mean, I think everybody out there has some kind of well-worn social groove. And, you know, are there practical ways that you'd suggest people get started venturing out of those lines? For example, in another post, you recently said, we know everybody reads Dawkins, Hitchens, and all that stuff. We can usually assume that in the atheist community, but why not break out and start reading other material? Can you speak to that a little bit?
The key, like I was alluded to before, would be immersion. Okay, so immersing ourselves into situations that we into situations where we encounter those of marginalized identities. We need to talk with them. We need to become more intimately familiar with what they're going through, what their struggle is, what their condition is, what their state of affairs are, because it differs. But more importantly than that is listening. We don't do enough of that in general. Listen to them. Read their work. Attempt to experience the world through their eyes. Now, we will never fully succeed in doing that, but through kindling empathy and working to identify with their condition and their feelings, we can attain a greater understanding of what they go through. And through this, we speak to our sphere of influence with a more substantive comprehension. Now, this is definitely needed when it comes to those of privileged identity, speaking to those who share their privileged identity. Take Tim Wise, for example. He uses his platform for anti-racist work, and due to his white and male privilege, he's able to reach people that would otherwise not be so receptive were coming from a black man or woman. So I think it's really important that, like I explained before, we need to really immerse ourselves into the world of others and step out actively and repeatedly step out of our comfort zones by undergoing that process of what I talked about, by observing constancy. So it's more than just if a tragedy happens and we talk about it for that moment. You know, you'll say, oh, this really makes me think about da 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 da. And then the next day you're on to something else. This is something that should be frequently addressed and visited. So when I'm thinking about, or I'm talking about the ways women are oppressed, I'm not sitting there saying this, oh man, yeah, that's wrong that happened. Then the next day I'm moving on to something else, you know, just because one incident happened. No, this is something that needs to be, this is a process that needs to be repeated. And I go out of my way to put myself in groups, and, or if I have a question, I go to those who I think are informed. I go to women about specific issues related to the way that they are discriminated against, the way they're oppressed, and so on and so forth. And I learn from them. And I read their work, their writings. I read women authors. I read their articles. I read their blogs. I visit their social media. Twitter is a good example of that. Not just with women, but say, for example, trans women, trans men. I go through, like, Twitter is something like there's subtle differences between Twitter and Facebook. Now I have both of them, so I follow people on both of marginalized groups. But on Twitter, especially, I have certain people that I follow, and you can really see certain things that happen, like on an everyday basis, the way they face certain discrimination that I can't comprehend because I'm not in that place. So when we're able to see these things and the way, because they'll also quote what happened to them or quote something nasty someone said to them, and you're able to get a better picture of the world that exists beyond my own limited world. And I think that's important.
Absolutely.
It's basically expanding your base a bit, expanding it to include a diversity of people. And does that also include a diversity of ideas? I have to say I'm guilty of not necessarily including all sides on my Facebook page. So just how far are we responsible to include all points of view?
Well, I'd say that depends. I think that's kind of tricky because social media, it's important to a certain extent or whatever, but that is, again, only one facet of reality. So, for example, I do the same things to a certain extent. Like when you were talking about politics, there's people that I strongly disagree with, but I don't unfollow everyone. I only unfollow people who tend to be like nasty or just say things. If someone can put forth a cogent argument and don't resort to ad hominem and things like that, I'll still, you know, I'll read what they have to say, even if I don't agree with it. And when it comes to politics, and I actually have someone, it's actually funny because when you're talking about this, there's one person in particular who I go out of my way to routinely talk to because he infuriates me so much. But I think to a certain extent, it helps me. It helps me keep me. I say to myself all the time, okay, this is helping me keep me honest, because he basically represents everything I write about, like everything. Now, when it comes to my personal life outside of social media, he wouldn't be someone that I would be able to actually be in the same room with all the time. But we talk behind closed doors. So we message each other on social media, and I'm probably 85% of our discussions aren't discussions. It's him saying these things, like everything you can imagine, basically everything I write about, he's like on the other spectrum. I'll put it like that. So that is.
This sounds like Thanksgiving dinner.
Yeah. So, I mean, now it's important to also have people, obviously, that are speaking to a multiplicity of issues. Or if you have, let's say you have a couple friends here that speak specifically to anti-racist issues, and they continue to publish or speak on anti-racist from an anti-racist perspective, that's good to have. You still gain perspective from that. And it's also good to have staunch feminist people or people who are for women liberation and to glean from them. And it's also good to have people who are coming from LGBTQIA communities, and they're relaying information to you and perspectives to you that you don't already have, even though you support them and you advocate for them. Obviously, we don't know everything. So it's always good to have those things come to you and to continuously consume that type of information, because it helps us to grow and be better people. So when it comes to opposing views, if you can put what you have to say in a way that isn't nasty, aren't disparaging people, you aren't denigrating people, and you're expressing your idea and you're putting it forth in a way that at least they feel is logical, then I can, you know, I that's fine.
So you do feel like it's appropriate for people outside of a particular subset of social justice to be able to critique ideas within the movement, you know, males putting forth a comment on arguments that a feminist activist is making. If they're arguing the logic and the reasonings of what the activist is saying, they should be free to do so.
I would say that also depends. That depends on the context of the disagreement. I don't think there's a definite one size fits all answer to that. So I think I can give a general rule of thumb to that, basically centers on the whole check our privilege thing. When it comes to addressing issues that don't directly impact our lives, I don't identify as a feminist, but I'm a staunch supporter of feminist goals of, you know, the feminist goal of social liberation. I also try to not self-identify as an ally, but rather I leave that up to women to describe me as such if I ever act in ways that reflect adequate allyship. So with this understanding, if I were to see a feminist activist say something that seems contrary or whatever, I believe I would seek out the advice of women who are feminists. And I don't think that I would directly engage, because I don't feel that it's my place to do so. If it were a man, it'd be different. But even having said that, I still think it depends on the exact circumstances and what's exactly being said, because there really isn't a one size fit all answer for that. But I think that is something that can be applied in general. Not just with in relation to that example you gave, but also with when you're talking about people of color, when you're talking about issues related to the LGBT community.
I've just seen that happen a lot lately, that just discussions seem to be getting shot down because one person is not within the right group, so to speak.
Well, I don't know. I think it depends, because to some extent, people are right to say that if a man that, you know, that expression, man comes in with his view. I mean, if a woman is addressing something that is directly related to women issues, then a man steps in and says, oh, well, actually, I mean, this, you just gotta.
Right. I think you're talking about mansplaining.
Yeah. I think. But I mean, that can also be applied more generally. Like, for example, I remember. So when it comes to, let's say, black conservatives, if the people who tend to be in the very, very, very minority of the black community, they're not even really part of the quote unquote black community. Like, for example, Stacey Dash. Now, when she goes and she says something reckless out of her mouth that denigrates the black community, you'll have, of course, you'll have certain types of people who say, oh, yeah, see, that's what I'm talking about. And then, like, or so you'll have white people who support her, obviously, for the things that she says. And then they will try to impart their commentary on black issues because they see Stacey Dash denigrating and tearing black people down. That's, you know, I'm like, all right, first of all. And then when I see that, I'm gonna check. I'm like, okay, first of all, you know, then I break down why what she says is problematic on multiple levels. And then I'll break down basically why what this person is saying is not something that should be applied to black people in general. Now, black people aren't a monolith, obviously, but seriously, we should not take people like Ben Carson and Alan West and Stacey Dash to represent anything related to the black community as a whole.
You're listening to The Humanist Hour. Today, Peggy Knutson and Jen Wilson are talking to Sincere Carrabo, the American Humanist Association's new social justice coordinator, about his role and what we can all do to promote social justice.
And you just have to break down their arguments with logic.
Yeah, but see, the thing is, I gave extreme examples, because usually stuff that comes out of those people's mouths that I just said is just so, such a huge departure from anything that most black people would agree with. So if you have a trans person, okay, if you have someone who's trans and they're speaking about something related to intimately with the trans experience, and then you have someone who isn't trans, who doesn't know anything about that experience beyond what they have seen or probably what they have observed, but they haven't actually experienced, for them to say something that against or whatever is going on about that particular social context, I think would be in some cases considered ill advised. And I think that'll be more important for them to seek out the perspective of other trans people before they actually try to insert themselves in a place where they aren't, you know, intimately familiar with what's going on.
I think that's great advice.
Yeah, it's all about finding the right manners and understanding, you know, the privilege that we rest in before we begin to speak, yeah, and how that influences the dialogue. We really have to be, all of us have to do a better job at being aware of that and granting these voices room to speak. So that leads me to another thing I was wondering about. I'm curious of your thoughts about social media in general and, you know, the way activism plays out within it. I'm curious whether you feel that enough voices are able to cross-pollinate across the usual social barriers in the world of social media, and how have social media helped and hindered your work in activism?
Well, I'd say that it definitely has helped more than it's hindered, because social media gives you the opportunity to amplify your voice and your reach. I think that social media activism has its place. I don't think it's the end all be all by any stretch of the imagination, but I do think that it can be an important one if it's used right. So, I mean, you have organizations like Positive Women's Network, where the one facet of their amazing activist work focuses mainly on strategically educating people through social media. In fact, they're one group that I'm actually trying to work with, actually. That's why I know that off the top of my head. It doesn't take much in general to catalyze change. So if we really think on it, many of us can recall a time when we came across something small or something simple that someone said or wrote that influenced the way we think to some extent. This is the butterfly effect. And I've seen it happen too many times to discount its importance. So what's amazing about this is some people who were able to become better informed through social media about something. And then they go and they share that with people in their sphere of influence, like children or relatives or friends. And then that minor change may upgrade the perspective of others who will then carry on that change to their sphere of influence and so on and so forth. So I think that social media allows you a chance to come across countless perspectives and countless avenues of information that we otherwise would not be able to come across. Because also with social media, you also have to take into consideration that for every news report, you'll have someone who, let's say, is quote unquote socially aware, that can take something that was dispensed through news and then relay that through their perspective, and they can impart some level of knowledge on you and allow you to see something that you didn't otherwise see in that news story that you read. So we could read the two, we both of us could read the same thing, and then they get something out of it that I didn't get, and they shared that with me. I think that's something that can be important.
Right. Social media gets a lot of knocks for the constant exposure and the frequent stimulation people have. We check in a lot. People can hear from each other a lot. And, you know, like you suggested earlier, it can really do a lot to open our eyes to the problems that just come up on a daily basis or even an hourly basis, the microaggressions that some demographics face all the time that we may not necessarily be aware of. And so there's a lot to be said for, you know, this idea of building awareness and how powerful it really is.
It can also be insulating, however, and reinforce bad ideas that we already hold.
Definitely. Agree with that, too. Oh, what's the name of that thing? Anyway, there's a, you know, for example, there's that that white nationalist website. That's a good example. I can't think of the name of it right now. Thing about that is, I do believe that's true. Everyone is prone to that, the insidious implications of the echo chamber effect. So like if you take The Orbit as an example, okay? The Orbit is a new blogging network of atheist writers who primarily focus on social justice issues. So you could call this network a form of an activist community in and of itself. And I'm a part of the network, so we share similar views on many things. Now, at the same time, the thing about this, when it comes to social justice issues, and especially when you're a writer, this type of work assumes the role of outreach, right? This passion drives you to engage with those who don't share your perspective. So when I write about ways I'm impacted by racism, when I pour out my experiences and my observations for the world to bear witness to, when I routinely cite what the secular community needs to do in order to achieve social progress, I'm not addressing people who already know or endure these social inequalities. I'm purposely reaching out to those who are uninformed or misinformed, or to those who rationalize or devalue or deny these issues. And I would argue that it's those who suffer ideological recoil from reading these issues parsed by whether it be me or others focused on social justice that come from, they come from environments that instill that echo chamber that routinely tell them that these things don't exist, or that these things aren't as dire or serious or common as they really are. So I think that it can be both beneficial and hurtful, well, hinder. But I think that when it comes to quote unquote activism, social media activism, I think that it can be used as a tool if used rightly and correctly and judiciously. I think that it is good because it can start discussions and that it can dispel certain narratives or tropes that just simply aren't true or extremely misrepresent certain marginalized groups.
You're hoping you're not just preaching to the choir, so to speak.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. My purpose is to, you know, when I'm speaking to, that's why, you know, and that's another thing, but that goes beyond social media. Like, I also do speaking engagements. If I'm doing speaking engagements, I'm not going to talk about something that I know everyone's already going to agree with. I think that's a waste of time. So I'll talk about, I purposely, and I don't do speaking engagements often. I'm selective. So when I do it, I am mindful of who I'm speaking to, who the audience will be. And then I make sure that I'm going to be talking about something that will, quote unquote, ruffle some feathers or whatever, or at least otherwise cause some people to think about things that they don't regularly do. And I try to do the same thing in my writing.
Does social justice encompass poverty? This is one thing I also want to know. We've talked about LGBT issues. We've talked about issues in the Black community, feminist issues. Does this also encompass issues with poverty? Are they all intertwined? How does that lead us as humanists to look at our own behavior, our own beliefs in regards to political positions? What do you think on that?
I think, well, first of all, I think that's a good question. And the problem is not enough people are addressing that. I think you're right. And I think, I don't know if you were privy to it, but just recently in January, we had the Secular Social Justice Conference. And right. One of the panels specifically focused on economic issues. Combating poverty, because that also intersects with certain marginalized groups. So I do think that's something that is part of social justice. When we're talking about social justice, I think that's also a part of it. We could call Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. We could call him a social justice activist by every sense of the term. That's what he was. And before he was assassinated, he was working on an initiative that directly addressed economic justice for poor people. And it was called the Poor People's Campaign. It was based on a belief in basic human rights. And I agree with the sentiment. So when we talk about social justice, we're really talking about addressing social and economic and political inequalities, as they're often, you know, they often intersect and people are marginalized in more than one way. And they continue to be disenfranchised due to the intersection of these factors. This is why seeking positions of political power ought to be a primary focus of the secular community, but it's largely being neglected. I think that also intersects with what you're talking about. My friend, Juhem Navarro Rivera, he was a panelist at, Secular Social Justice, at the conference. He's a humanist and he's a political scientist, and he frequently discusses this issue specifically. He works for a think tank and he has his own blog and he discusses these things on a regular basis. And he says all too often, we talk about the secular community, humanists, he says, we're on the defensive, reacting to religiously influenced legislation instead of going on the offensive and attempting to gain political power to initiate changes within the political system. And for those who would do that and those who are humanist and social justice oriented, that I think would better address those economic issues. I think he's right. But yeah, definitely when it comes to social justice movements, that's definitely something that we need to hone in more on. You're right.
And do we have a responsibility to put it out there that we are humanists and we are addressing these issues as humanists, or even labeling ourselves when we do small things like volunteering? I have been told that we shouldn't wear it on our sleeves just like religious people do, because that makes us just as shallow. But I sort of feel like, how will anyone know who we are if we don't put it out there?
I think there are two. I see the matters being divergent, and we must consider the high tendency and the frequency in which religious groups or organizations are advertised as being part of this or that initiative to help the poor or involved in disaster relief and so on. I think it's important for humanists to, you know, let it be known that we do exist and that we are out there, because more often than not, what we see is the religious people getting the credit for doing certain things, and meanwhile it appears as though atheists or humanists aren't doing anything. I recently addressed this very misperception that humanists aren't doing anything about mass incarceration. The allegation was declared by this black humanist. He saw something that I wrote on mass incarceration, and he had this belief that it was made possible by the fact that not nearly enough humanists advertise the fact that they do combat matters related to racial injustice in the criminal justice system, or combat other expressions of the prison industrial complex, or they in general do not do like religious people so often do. But they also have organizations, you know, that we know are religious institutions. We, on the other hand, there's a tendency, more of a tendency for us to just get in there and just do it. Or if we do announce that we're humanists, it's not really visible and often lost in the shuffle of the more visible and more numerous religious institutions. So since this is the case, at least as I see it, I think it's a good thing for us to openly identify and to let people know that it certainly isn't the case that we need any direction from a priest, pope, preacher, or archaic religious text to kindle compassion needed to help others. That's my opinion on that.
Amen.
Absolutely. And yeah, once again, we're in a culture where, you know, so much of the, so to speak, dialogue in the media and in a lot of the coverage that people are exposed to all the time, it's all about picking a label. It's all about picking a side. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as humanists, I know I've met a lot of people who really want to shy away from that need to pick a side. We just want to get out there and start making the world a better place. But, mm-hmm. you know, that comes across, you know, looking like we're dodging something. So we've got to find a way to fit into this dialogue somehow.
Definitely. That also reminds me of Smart Recovery, the alternative to Alcoholics Anonymous. That's actually based on, more accurately, on research and science of rehab and stuff. I think that's something that should more widely be advertised for. It's just an example, but that's one example where secular based alternatives are just something that we usually just don't hear that much about.
All right. Well, what's the best way for our listeners to find you online and keep up with what you're doing? And in closing, what can we all do to help support you in the work and do our part?
I write regularly for thehumanist.com. I also write for Everyday Feminism. I have two articles that will be coming out, at least one article a month. And then also my blog at Pathios, Notes from an Apostate. Then also I have a second blog now with the Orbit, and it's called Missives from the Ether. As far as how to support my work, I would say just continue to follow, because I'm going to have some updates actually pretty soon as far as my work as a social justice coordinator for the American Humanist Association. So I'll have some updates real soon that I can't talk about right now, but when it's ready, everybody, I'll put it out there and it'll be on one or more of those avenues that I just discussed.
And you have a Facebook page and a Twitter
@SinCarabo, and Facebook. I don't even know what that is. But yeah, just look up my name.
We will.
And I understand you'll be at the AHA conference this May in Chicago, correct?
Yes, I'll actually be a moderator for a humanism and social justice panel. It's going to be awesome. So people need to come and see that.
Fantastic. I think I will be there as well. So I look forward to meeting you.
All right. Awesome.
Thank you for your time. And we're behind you all the way. Thank you for your work.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much, Sincere.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
As always, we value your feedback on the show. Have a comment or question for today's guests? Have a suggestion for a guest you'd like us to interview? Email us at humanisthour@americanhumanist.org or call our listener feedback line at 202-618-1371. Thank you again for listening to The Humanist Hour, the official broadcast of the American Humanist Association.